From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Democrats are preparing to wrap up their case in the impeachment trial of former President Trump, and they're citing Trump's speech right before last month's Capitol insurrection as an example of the many ways he encouraged the attack. Trump told his supporters, "If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore." The former president's defenders argue his words were political speech and are protected by the First Amendment. Here is his attorney, Bruce Castor, earlier this week.
We can't possibly be suggesting that we punish people for political speech in this country.
For more clarity on this argument, we have with us Ilya Soman, a law professor at George Mason University. Mr. Soman, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Professor, over the last few days, we've heard this argument for and against the idea that Trump's words were protected by the First Amendment. You make the case that the First Amendment does not protect government officials from being impeached and convicted for their free speech. Why is the standard different for officials than public citizens, private citizens, I should say?
It's not that it's different. It's that freedom of speech for anybody simply doesn't include a right not to be fired from a government job for it or not to be barred from being hired in the first place. Government officials are fired for their speech all the time. Indeed, Donald Trump himself removed numerous subordinates over the years because they said things he didn't like. And similarly, there's nothing preventing the Senate from concluding that if Trump deserves to be convicted, that he should be barred from holding office in the future as a result of what he said, because the right to hold government office is not a part of freedom of speech.
Well, some Republicans argue this is a slippery slope and sets a dangerous precedent to impeach a president that has neither practiced nor preached violence directly. For instance, if a president said directly and explicitly, go commit a violent crime, for instance, do they have a point?
No, I don't think they do. First of all, he actually has praised violence by his supporters on multiple occasions, going all the way back to the 2016 presidential campaign. Second, regardless of that, I think there's little need for any worry about slippery slopes with impeachment because there's a high supermajority bar for conviction that requires two-thirds of the Senate to vote for it. So as a practical matter, no president can be convicted unless a large percentage of his own party, the senators from his own party, also vote for it. And it's very unlikely that they would vote to convict the president of their own party for some kind of a frivolous reason. If anything, we should worry more about the opposite slippery slope, which is of presidents getting away with severe abuses of power and not being held accountable for it. Sadly, that's what actually has been the problem that we've encountered over the last few years, particularly with Trump, but certainly not exclusively with him.
Okay. Can you give an example of some past cases that maybe have set the precedent here?
Certainly. There have been impeachments for speech going all the way back to the dawn of the Republic, when in the early years of the Republic, two federal judges were impeached and one convicted for speech that was inappropriate to their offices, even though certainly if a private citizen had said the same thing, he couldn't be sent to prison for it or subjected to criminal punishment.
Okay. You know, Republicans are bringing up the First Amendment a lot right now, not to just defend Trump, but Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has also claimed that she's being silenced, and she has endorsed violence against officials in the past. Does a member of Congress face a different standard than the president in terms of what speech is protected?
No. And in fact, when she was stripped of her committee assignments recently because of her speech, hardly anybody said that that was a violation of the First Amendment. It's because this was another situation of somebody losing a political position rather than one where she's sent to prison or fined or subjected to any kind of criminal or civil punishment. But politicians all the time lose positions of power because of their speech, and in no way does that violate the First Amendment. If it does, then Trump violated the First Amendment every time he fired a subordinate who said things that he didn't like.
Yeah, you know, the First Amendment is such a fundamental part of our identity in this country. I want, with the 1 minute that I have with you, ask you, do you think the First Amendment is misunderstood overall by the public and maybe even our elected officials?
I think much of the time they understand it quite well, but there is abusive misunderstanding when some people think that the First Amendment protects people from losing positions of political power because of their speech. That's a badly flawed application of the idea.
Yeah, and you're saying, in light of what we expect to happen with this impeachment trial, the thing that we should be thinking about is what will happen if Trump is not held responsible for what he said.
Yes, I think that's right. And not just what he said, but also what he did over a course of many weeks in trying to overturn the result of an election that he lost.
Ilya Soman is a law professor at George Mason University and an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute. He's the author of Free to Move, Foot Voting, Migration, and Political Reform. Professor, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
A new study from the CDC says that wearing two masks can drastically reduce the spread of the coronavirus. Researchers found that transmission between two people can go down by 96% if both are properly masked. Dr. Saskia Popescu is an epidemiologist at the University of Arizona, and she joins us now. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
We've been hearing about the efficacy of double masking for a while now. So what exactly is this new CDC study telling us?
So what this study did was actually experiment to improve fit. And the goal was to really look at this from a community level and really assess what we're using in the community, which are cloth masks and, you know, the widely available surgical masks. So they did two different assessments. One was putting a cloth mask over a medical procedure mask, or commonly known as a surgical mask. And then the other one was knotting the ear loops of the medical mask and flattening, you know, tucking in those extra materials. So they did those, you know, they used those two pieces, and then they studied it, and they found some really helpful and interesting results. So the first one is, if we look at source control, the emissions by coughing, they found that just a mask alone, regardless if it's cloth or surgical, does source control by 42%. But if you did the combination, actually, so surgical mask with a cloth mask over it, you actually were able to block 93% of the cough particles.
Oh, wow. And the other way around?
So that's the best part. If the person who's sick is unmasked, but you're protected, they actually found that exposure was reduced by 83% with the double approach and 64% with the knotting approach. If both people have these strategies, they were able to really improve and reduce exposure by 96%, which is really what's good.
That is really great news to hear for people. Now, can we define what we mean by double mask? So you mentioned cloth mask on top of a surgical mask. This is not a surgical mask on top of a surgical mask, nor is it a mask on top of an N95 mask.
Correct. So N95s and KN95s fit the face a lot better. Of course, you know, they're not perfect because to truly get that N95 fit, you do need to be fit tested. So that's why we use them in healthcare, because we have the capacity to do fit testing. But if you have access to N95s or KN95s, of course, always make sure that you're checking with the CDC website to make sure that they're not counterfeit. Do that little seal test, you know, make sure it's fitting around your cheeks, your nose, and your chin snugly. If you're kind of steaming up your glasses, that's a bad sign.
Yeah. So when you go out in public and you're not in a clinical setting, what do you wear? What's your mask wearing strategy?
I actually wear a surgical mask because I have some that fit my face really well. And that's kind of the challenge, right? Because it's really about what fits your face. For some people, they have a really good coverage with a KN95. I also use those if I'm traveling. But really, I wear a surgical mask most of the time because I have one that I've not had any fit issues with.
The CDC also released some new advice today saying that fully vaccinated people actually don't need to quarantine if they've been exposed to COVID-19. And I want to ask, get your reaction to that. Now that more people are getting vaccinated, this might become very relevant.
Definitely. And I think this is very exciting. It's preliminary data. So if you look at the CDC criteria, it says if you were vaccinated and you're within 3 months of that, getting your second dose, and you're exposed and not experiencing any symptoms, you don't need to quarantine. So the key piece to this is that the 3 month notion, and you know, people kind of hit the panic button about that. But the truth is that that's the data that we have from phase 3 trials. This likely will evolve as we get more information. But right now, it's really important to remember this is good, this is exciting, but it's also very preliminary. So that 3 months will hopefully expand.
it doesn't necessarily mean that the vaccine stops working after 3 months. We just don't know yet.
The truth is that when the CDC releases guidance, it's very impacting because states tend to use that guidance and apply it there. So this is data that we're feeling very confident in. So that's why you see 3 months. That doesn't mean the vaccine isn't going to last longer. It just means we want to make sure before we put out guidance.
Dr. Saskia Popescu, an epidemiologist at the University of Arizona. Doctor, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The nominees for the Best Documentary Feature Oscar were announced this week, which narrows the field from 238 films to just 15. The final nominees will be announced next month. One on the list is Time, which features the story of Rob and Fox Rich, high school sweethearts who married and started a family in the early 90s. During a time of desperation, the two made a failed attempt to rob a bank, and both were sentenced to prison. Fox served 3.5 years, and Rob was sentenced to 60 without the possibility of parole. After Fox Rich was released, she spent the next 2 decades working to free Rob while raising the couple's 6 boys. In the film, Fox reflects on those years.
Time is when you look at pictures from when your babies were small, and then you look at them and you see that they have mustaches and beards. And that the biggest hope that you had was that before they turned into men, they would have a chance to be with their father.
Rob Fox was granted clemency in 2018 after serving 21 years in prison. Time is available on Amazon Prime, and we spoke with Fox and Rob Rich when the film was first released last October. Fox, I want to start with you. A lot of the film is video that you shot yourself over the years when Rob was incarcerated. Did you shoot that video so that you could show Rob what was going on while he was in prison?
You know, I actually picked up my camera, Tanya, because when I married Rob, it was the happiest moment of my life. And I was so excited that we had started a family. I wanted to document every aspect of it. 6 months into marriage, we found ourselves facing 297 years in prison. And so I wanted to capture those moments so that whenever we could move past this, we could hold on to some of those moments together and they wouldn't be a total loss for Rob.
Rob, you had a lot of material there over the years that you were able to see. What did you think as you saw those images of all of those events that took place while you were in prison?
It was a bittersweet kind of moment for me. You know, one, just realizing how much time had managed to escape us. At the same time, sweet and knowing that it was finally over, or at least that phase of what we were experiencing was finally over.
Yeah, you know, the big timestamp were the twins, because Fox, you were pregnant with the twins when he went away to prison. And then we got to watch you go through raising them. And then your other timestamp was like, I want him out of prison before the twins turn 18 years old. This film was directed by Garrett Bradley. How easy or difficult was it to open your home and really bare your soul to filmmakers? I mean, what did you think when she first approached you about making a film?
You know, I just was honored because, one, just to have someone as young and talented as Garrett Bradley is, have a desire to tell our story, which is not just me and Rob's story, but the story of 2.3 million Americans that are incarcerated and their families. More so when we connected for the first time, I knew that our family was in love with her and that through that love, we would be able to tell one of the greatest love stories of all time, a story of radical love and resilience.
The robbery that got both of you sent to prison was to fund a hip hop clothing store. One of the other striking things about this film is that we see what remorse looks like, your pain, your children's pain. How many times over the years did you ask yourself, what were you thinking?
You know, I think we concluded a long time ago that we as human beings have to give ourselves rooms to make the not so good choices and still know that we can be okay in knowing that I'm not the worst thing I've ever done. One of the most powerful moments for me was when Rob reminded us of what happened to us. And he says, baby, we lost our confidence because of the action we had made, but we got to forgive ourselves. We made a bad choice, Fox. We're not bad people. And so when you can settle into that, you must, as a formerly incarcerated person, not buy into I'm bad or I'm less than or the labeling of convicted felon, because it will really take you down a road. You got to love yourself enough to forgive yourself so that others, you feel like you have earned the forgiveness of others. And that's what Rob and I and our family tried to do, be better than the worst thing that we have done.
Mm. Rob, the love that Fox has for you, I mean, it kind of leapt out of the screen.
Wow. he had me crying. I mean, that's the only thing that really got me about this film of Gary Bradley's is that she opens it up with me crying the love of this man.
It definitely is felt like it's palpable. I think anyone watching this knows it and understands it. Mm. But I want to know, Rob, did you feel it in prison? And was that part of what got you through?
I definitely felt Fox's love. It was able to penetrate through prison walls, and was so thankful to hear when the film came out, one of her speaking engagements where she was talking to a group of young ladies and she was talking to them about identifying their significant other. And she said that whoever that someone is, that someone should be who you would be if you were in the male body. So for her to think that I am her and she is me.
You shouldn't even have me blushing after 34 years. Isn't this ridiculous?
That's amazing. But Rob, did you ever feel like during your time in prison that you might not get released? I mean, 60 years without parole was your sentence.
It was, but my commitment to Fox and my family was greater than that. And I had committed and made a vow before the altar that I would be married to her till death do us part. And part of that is also making sure that nothing or no one would take us under. And that included the system of Louisiana's criminal justice system. Dying in prison or not getting out of prison was never for either of us.
No.
There's so many feelings I think that people will have when they watch the film. We see in the film over the next two decades, Fox, you calling judges, talking to secretaries. At one point, you talk about a high-priced lawyer that took thousands of dollars and then told you that nothing could be done. And all I kept thinking about was something you said earlier about so many others who are incarcerated and don't have Foxes in their lives.
You know, and it is a tragedy, I think, what incarceration does to a family, period. And it's not even about having Foxes in their lives. They have to be their own Fox. And Rob had to be his own Rob. This was definitely a collaborative effort. I just think one of the most powerful comments to me was Lincoln's, when he said that determine a thing must be done, and then we shall find a way. We as citizens, everyday human beings, we have to determine that a thing must be done. Rob and I always knew we would restore our family. It was just a matter of what way would be available to us.
Hmm. As I mentioned earlier, one of the most bittersweet parts of the film are your sons. I mean,
aren't they adorable? Oh my gosh. I love those boys. They make us so proud.
But we're not talking one or two or three. You have a house full of boys. How did you keep Rob alive for them to be like a real presence in the family?
I think that Rob just did it for himself because he was determined. Well, you know, your fathering technique.
Right.
Yeah.
I know for me, one big thing is an article that I read in a men's health magazine once, and they spoke about the fact that the average American father spends about 8 hours per month engaged with their children. And when I thought about the fact that we were afforded at least two visits per month, each visit could last, you know, in excess of 6 to 7 hours per visit. When I looked at that, I figured, I said, well, I could contend with the average father. If they're only being able to put 8 hours of engagement time into their children, then I could manage to put the same amount of time into my kids. Hence, started my journey of fathering from behind bars.
Hmm.
And Father, he does. It has just been, you know, people like to give me the credit because I'm the one that they see. But he is like Charlie on the other line telling the angels what to do. Because when those rascals would try to be little young men on me, I would say, you just wait to visit. You're going to go see your father this weekend, you know. And just think, now you take them to visit. And it wasn't like their father has never so much as raised his voice at them. But just the thought of going to address a situation with him was moving enough for them to get themselves together.
You know, this film really lays out the realities of incarceration. And Fox, I mean, you've said this. There are families behind people who make bad decisions. And yes, you've done the crime and now you do the time, but the pain and the trauma is real. What's the message you want people to take away from this film?
I think what Rob said earlier is that love never fails. Love is life's only valid expression, and it dissolves everything that is not of itself. And then the other piece would be never give up. Anything worth having in this life is worth fighting for. Our families are worth having. Our families are worth having. And therefore, no matter what situation we find ourselves in, we must fight for them.
Rob.
My message is that people will walk away from the film empowered, because it's kind of like one of those David and Goliath moments where you go up against the system. And, you know, our family went up against the system of Louisiana, and we came out victorious on the end. That I'm hoping that this movie serves as a call to action to people.
Yes.
That they will start to take action and right the wrongs that they want to see corrected.
Rob and Fox Rich are the focus of the documentary Time, which is on the short list for an Oscar for Best Documentary Feature. Nominations will be announced on March 15th, and the Oscars are on April 25th.
But we have to live right to get the time.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
Decades before the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, Marcus Garvey attracted millions of followers with a message of Black self-sufficiency and Black nationalism in Africa.
For our Black History Month special series, The Seismic Influence and Complicated Legacy of Marcus Garvey.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Royal Dutch Shell is planning to shift away from fossil fuels and invest in cleaner energy. And it's a big shift. Shell projects it will cut gas and diesel production by 55% in the next 10 years. The announcement follows similar plans by rivals BP and Total as global demand for oil continues to fall. Here's Shell CEO Ben Van Beurden talking to CNBC this morning.
I think a lot of people would agree with me that we're not moving fast enough as a society to address the challenge of climate change.
Let's bring in NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley for more on this story. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Peter.
And back in September, Shell announced its goal of reaching net zero emissions by 2050. So what does today's statement say about how the company's going to reach that goal?
They're planning to invest in less polluting forms of energy, so less diesel fuel, less gasoline, more liquid natural gas, more hydrogen. They also want to increase by more than tenfold the number of Shell service stations that recharge electric cars rather than pumping gas. They're not getting out of the fossil fuel business altogether, though, so they're also planning to invest in, you know, planting new forests and grasslands and that kind of thing to offset the carbon that they do produce.
I see. Well, there was some concern among many energy companies that oil demand would never return to levels seen before the pandemic. So what is the state of the oil industry right now?
It was hit pretty hard last year. You know, demand for oil fell by about 10% in 2020 when people were driving and flying a lot less because of the pandemic. Remember last spring, we actually saw the price of oil drop below zero for a brief period of time. You couldn't give the stuff away. That spelled big losses for the energy giants. Exxon lost more than $22 billion last year. Chevron lost more than $5 billion. The price has been coming up again now, partly because of demand coming back and also because the Saudis have cut their production to put a floor under the price. Just this week, the international benchmark Brent crude topped $60 a barrel for the first time in a year. West Texas Intermediate's not far behind. You can see this when you gas up. Gas prices are now averaging just under $2.50 a gallon. That's up close to 20 cents in the last month, and it's a little bit higher than it was this time last year. Just a side note, I noticed in the Wall Street Journal this morning, propane prices have soared 70% since November.
Wow.
And up more than fourfold since last spring. That's thanks in part to all those outdoor space heaters that are suddenly so popular this winter. So if you sell propane and propane accessories, you feel like king of the hill right now.
Business is good. Well, listen, those fluctuating prices are all short-term. Long-term, Shell and European competitors BP and Total are in this race to reinvent themselves, partly in response to slowing demand, but it's also pressure from investors and also from climate activists. On the other hand, it's expensive to retool at a time when oil companies have been losing a lot of money. So how do you think they're going to do this long-term?
Yeah, it is a real race, and we're going to see. You know, it's a bit like the move you're seeing here in this country with General Motors saying they plan to move to an all-electric line of cars and trucks in 15 years, which is a big, costly commitment. And they're going to try to bankroll that with their most profitable vehicles, which are big, less efficient cars and trucks that run on gasoline. So the challenge is threefold. You know, can the engineers make the technical advances? Will consumers push the pedal the right way? And will policymakers set the kind of ground rules that move companies and consumers in that direction?
We should note, and this will have to be for another time, that U.S. companies like ExxonMobil and Chevron are actually pushing back against calls to change their business. We'll pick that up later. NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You may have heard the story recently of Joe DiMeo, the 22-year-old from New Jersey who was horribly disfigured in a car accident. Well, last week, doctors announced that 6 months ago, he had a double hand transplant and a face transplant. It is the first successful transplant surgery of its kind in the world. Joe's surgeon, Dr. Eduardo Rodriguez at NYU Langone Health, joins us now. And before we bring him in, a warning that some people may find the details of this story disturbing. Doctor, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And first, tell me about Joe DiMeo's case and how he came to you.
Joe's a remarkable individual and had an unfortunate set of circumstances. He was driving home following a night shift and fell asleep on a pretty busy highway and rolled over his car. Fortunately, an innocent bystander crossed the median and pulled him out of the car right before it exploded. But at that point, he had already sustained third-degree burns of his skin and about 80% of his body. He was taken to an acute burn center in New Jersey where he was in a medically induced coma for approximately 3.5 months, underwent multiple procedures. I got to see him in March of 2019. His accident was in July of 2018. And at that point, the close examination of his face and his hands were pretty bad off. His face was severely scarred. Eyelids were melted together. Didn't have much of a nose. The ears were burnt off. The lips were all scarred together. His neck was scarred. He had such thick scarring around his hands. His hands were like mittens. And he couldn't really use his hands well.
Did you think that you'd be able to help him?
Yes. The face, for sure, we could treat. But when I looked at his hands, I had never done a hand transplant before. And when I thought about combining the face and the hands, looking back at the history, there had been two attempts in the world, and I know that both of them were unsuccessful. So that was kind of in the back of my mind.
Well, that is just so remarkable, Doctor, that you are able to do for the first time a hand, double hand transplant and a face transplant. I'm not even sure which one to focus on first, the face or the hands. But as far as a surgery goes, which one is most noteworthy to you?
Well, it's always patient-centered. And when I asked Joe, what's most important to you? He said his hands. He said, without my hands, I can't gain my independence and I can't go back to work. And without my hands, I can't drive. And I go, I appreciate that. I understand that. But without a face, your eyelids won't work and you won't be able to have a visual field to drive and do your work. And he understood that. And that's when I said, I think we're going to have to do your face and hands together. I put together a team of face and hand surgeons within my department. We've met as a group. We discussed the options, and then we began to rehearse for such an operation in a simulation lab.
Well, I want to get to all of this, but let's talk about the surgery itself. How intensive and difficult is that surgery? I understand you were in the operating room, I think, almost an entire day.
Yes, that's correct. I lead the team, and I've been the one that's been involved in three prior face transplants, so I understand the setting and how things work, because in a transplant, it's a totally different set of rules, because when you have a donor, time is of the essence, because there are people whose lives depend on receiving those life-saving organs. So we have to time this perfectly. And when we look at Joe's scenario, he is right-hand dominant. So my primary focus was on amputating his existing damaged right hand and replacing it with the new donor hand. If the right hand was moving along well, then we would perform the completion amputation on the left hand and then reattach the new left donor hand. And if that was moving along well, then we would remove his existing scarred face and replace it with a new face. So all of that had to occur perfectly, well orchestrated, without missing a beat. To get to that point, we have to practice, think about, rehearse, study a great deal.
I want to ask you, I want to find a sensitive way to ask this question. The donor, was the donor of the hands and the face the same person? And how did you arrange that?
Yes, the face and hand donor was the same person. And that helps us craft the very selective immune suppressive medication regimen, because Joe will have to be on anti-rejection meds for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
And Peter, if we see any changes in the antibody profile over time, we can actually treat it before it actually becomes a full-blown rejection. So receiving tissues from one donor helps us a great deal.
So as you said, there are chances for rejection, of course, in any transplant surgery. But how is Joe doing now? I've read that he's actually, this is astounding, he's able to lift weights and has a pretty strong grip. Is that right?
That is correct. That is correct. It's impressive, Peter, when you see him. There's so many elements of Joe that made him the ideal candidate, but I think the biggest one is that he has such a spirit, and that's what allows him to persevere. And beyond survival, it's, you know, I'm going to overcome any adversity. And he's a guy, he often uses the term, you know, I roll with the punches, and, you know, literally he does, and he just keeps going. He doesn't give up. But watching him at the gym working out, just to see these hands that were transplanted from one person and they're on him now, it's remarkable. His grip strength is pretty strong. Every day he gains more and more intrinsic hand function. Intrinsic hand function gives you the ability kind of to spread your fingers in your hand, bring them together, move them around independently. And that continues to improve as the nerves continue to regenerate. But he's an impressive individual.
I mean, it sounds like it. I would imagine, though, that he does have many challenges ahead of him, and I wonder how many of those will be emotional challenges, because it seems almost beyond human comprehension to think that a person could look in a mirror and see themselves with a different face. How do people handle that? You've done a few of these surgeries.
Yeah. Patients don't have an identity crisis when they have a face from someone else. Their identity crisis is existing when they look at themselves in the mirror with the deformity that they have. That's the crushing blow. And I've seen that when we give these patients a new face with normal anatomic features, in other words, normal eyelids, a normal nose, cheeks, lips, ears, and they look in the mirror and that face begins to adapt to their underlying skeleton, they will all tell you unanimously that that face is them. When they look in the mirror, they see themselves. These patients are very accepting of their new face, and they say it is them, and they move on their lives. It's what we've seen. It's remarkable.
It's remarkable for Joe DiMeo. It's also remarkable for medicine. I mean, you say that nothing like this has ever happened before, in the sense that there has been a face and double hand transplant at the same time. So congratulations to you also. I mean, how are you feeling about all this?
I feel great, Peter, I'll tell you. And when I thought about this, because there have been two previous attempts, one in France and one here in our own country in Boston, and they both failed. Actually, the patient in France had unfortunate infectious complications that led to his demise. And the patient here in Boston, the face survived, but the hands had to be removed 5 days after the procedure. Throughout the world, there have been over 100 hand transplants performed successfully and close to 50 faces. I couldn't find a reason in my mind why we could not do these two elements together. And that's what we proved. And if we could procure tissues from one donor and perform these transplants, that just offers patients tremendous amount of hope. And it gives us more opportunities to help people. And that just, you know, science and medicine is advancing all the time. And that's just a great breakthrough for all of us.
You say Joe was sort of like one of the most dedicated patients you've ever seen. Tell me a little bit more about Joe, the person. What should we know about him?
Well, when I met Joe, his nickname was Joey Whispers, because he wasn't a guy that talked a lot, but, you know, very confident. He's healthy, likes to be with his friends, sociable, and actually a great sense of humor. And then when you look at him now, after the transplant, we joke around, and I call him Joey Hollywood, because now he's like talking to everyone. You know, he feels great. You know that this was the right operation for him, and it kind of resets the clock for him. And I'm so glad that he's doing so well.
Dr. Eduardo Rodriguez at NYU Langone Health, what a story. Thank you so much for taking some time to tell us about it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Peter, for the interview.
You know, singing the national anthem is so much a part of sporting events that it became news when the Dallas Mavericks stopped playing it at the start of their preseason games. That is until yesterday, when the NBA reasserted their policy that all games must start with the anthem. And for more, we're joined by Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hey there.
Hello.
Okay, so last night's game between the Mavericks and the Atlanta Hawks opened with the Star Spangled Banner once again. But this all goes back to Mark Cuban, who owns the Mavericks. He explained his decision of not starting the games with the national anthem on ESPN last night. Let's listen.
I stand for the national anthem. My hand is always over my heart. We've supported the National Flag Foundation and done work with them. You know, that isn't the issue at all. The real issue is how do you express the voices of those who feel the anthem doesn't represent them or causes them consternation?
Mike Cuban claims that he actually consulted with NBA Commissioner Adam Silver. What explains the NBA's sudden reversal?
Well, I don't think it was a sudden reversal. I think what Mark Cuban, who is one of the smarter owners in sports, what he was doing was questioning an assumption. The assumption is, you know, the anthem is always played. Of course it is. Except if you go to places overseas before there are sporting events, I'm not talking about a national team, just two club teams playing. They won't be playing their national anthem. And though it's always been done, the question is why? And then it became a flashpoint with kneeling and maybe thrusting a decision upon players or a source of stress upon players that they'd have to kneel, that they'd get criticism for kneeling. And Cuban just sort of ripped that up. He consulted with members of his own team and his own community. He said, what do you think about this? Several of the players and other people in the Dallas community says, I think it does not serve our worldview or does not play into our interest to always play the anthem. So he said, okay, I'm going to undo this assumption. And he did it for 15 games, and it wasn't really noticed. It's kind of remarkable. And in fact, it parallels Colin Kaepernick, who didn't stand for the anthem for several games before anyone noticed. Then it, of course, becomes a flashpoint. And now he's explaining why he did this. He is going back to playing the anthem. You know, though it doesn't make sense, think about the logos of all three major North American sports leagues, the NBA, the Major League Baseball, the NFL. The colors of those logos are all red, white, and blue. They want to be wrapped up with Americana. But I did see, I don't know if there's a coda, but I did see a headline on Fox Sports saying this stance means that Mark Cuban will never be president. So I didn't know that was in the offing. But cue the Hamilton song, right? You're never going to be president.
Right. I mean, I hear what you're saying about this is not necessarily an NBA reversal, but does this indicate to you at all that the NBA is dialing back its support of racial justice and racial justice protesters who kind of push the NBA to be thinking more deeply about this?
I don't think so, because Adam Silver always made clear that they always had a policy and they would always be playing the anthem. One of the things the NFL got in trouble with is they didn't have a clear policy. So Adam Silver always said, we will play the anthem, and has always said, and we will support our players, not only right to kneel, but inclination to kneel. So none of that has changed. When this happens with Dallas, he's in a position, do we now reverse the policy or say that any individual, you know, initiating their own carve out of the policy is okay? So as commissioner, he, I think, was right to say, no, we have to follow the rules. But remember, the rules are that we support players kneeling and making other statements of social justice.
Yeah. And Mark Cuban says that the Mavericks will still listen to community members regarding the anthem and kind of get them to weigh in on this. Meanwhile, the NBA wants to get more fans to in-person games this season. How do they plan to accomplish this?
Well, they're going along with the pace of the pandemic. And, you know, in New York State, Andrew Cuomo, they did open restaurants for limited indoor dining. And he announced that the Knicks and Nets can start having fans in a couple of weeks. I'm looking at the NBA attendance report. Currently, there are only 10 teams that allow fans in their arenas. And the highest average attendance is the Toronto Raptors. Wait, you're saying Toronto Raptors? Well, they're playing this year in Tampa. And that average attendance is only 3,000. So it will be spacing. California will not be allowing their teams to host fans. And it is basically just looking at the course of the pandemic and making their policy based on that.
Before I let you go, I want to talk about college basketball, specifically Howard University had to cancel their season due to the coronavirus after securing that top prospect, McCore Maker. He made a point actually of attending the historically black university to encourage other black athletes to do the same. This is a big deal.
Oh, this is a shame. This is just such a shame, because when Maker said, I'm going to attend Howard, this wasn't just an unusual school to attend. Howard is a historically black college. They don't have anywhere near the funding of the big schools. They don't play in a power conference. They haven't had a winning season since 2001, 2002. And Maker isn't just a good player. He's a five-star player, one of the best.
Now,
because of the pandemic, he won't get the chance to play for them.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, as always. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.